Okay, firstly, a couple of words of thanks to, particularly to Ron, Cynthia and team for organising what's up until this point been a great conference. Also, just to say thanks to my supervisor, Steve Harris, who's the co-author of the study behind the results I'm going to display today. And then on to some apologies. For those of you that were here yesterday, I apologise, there'll be no unicorns. I really want to talk about, get away from the hypothetical and talk about the empirical and the practical situation in zoos. And also an apology that the focus of this presentation is on the situation in British zoos. But I think it'll be hopefully self-evident that there are implications for the situation in North America and further afield in terms of USDA, AZA accreditation, that type of thing. And really just to pitch where I'm coming from, this is the subtitle of this conference is Advancing Zoo Animal Welfare Science and Policy. And I think this is really the what I'm going to present now is the interface between science and policy, or at least one aspect of that. So, that's not worked already. There we go. Okay. I was looking for a way of obtaining an objective picture of the current state of animal welfare in zoos on a very broad level. Obviously, individual zoos undertake their own assessments, but we, you know, it's a national industry, it's a global industry, and really I was just trying to find a way of getting a handle on the current state of affairs, and also to see whether there was a way of developing a risk-based approach to zoo animal welfare. So what I'm going to present on is an investigation of animal welfare in British zoos, which is more than 25 years after the implementation of our main piece of legislation relating to zoo animals and their welfare, which is the Zoo Licensing Act, which actually came into force in 1984. And I'm going to present some results based on the reports of government-appointed zoo inspectors. So in essence, this is a retrospective analysis of the current regulatory system. So a little bit of background on the licensing and inspection regime in the UK. Basically, it falls to local authorities, of which there are about 400 or so in the UK, to issue zoo licences under the relevant legislation. These zoos are, they include things like aquaria, bird of prey centres, as well as your traditional metropolitan mixed collections. The definition in Europe is that a facility keeping animals, wild animals for public display that's open to the public for 7 days or more in a year that isn't a pet shop or a circus. So obviously there'll be a wide range of facilities within this, perhaps outside of what you're expecting, but they are all licensed as zoos and as such they will have to meet minimum standards. The local authorities will inspect zoos on an informal basis on an annual frequency for many other things, as well as animal welfare, but also public health and safety. But as part of a formal inspection regime, government-appointed zoo inspectors are brought in roughly for formal inspections every 3 years. So they do represent, albeit an infrequent system of inspection, they're designed to be independent and top-level inspections. So the inspectors, the group of inspectors comprise of two parts, veterinarians and what are classed as competent others, who would be individuals from within the zoo industry that are deemed to be competent and knowledgeable enough to talk about the issues facing zoos. And they're recruited on the basis of their accuracy, their observation skills and their objectivity. And the reliability between and consistency between the inspectors is ensured by their experience, their shared experience. They are issued with a guidance handbook and they attend fairly regular training seminars. And that's summarised by the mission statement, which is to inspect zoos and provide consistent advice to local authorities with the aim of monitoring and promoting high standards of animal care and husbandry in zoos. I must emphasise they don't just look at animal welfare, they look at the conservation performance of zoos and public health and safety issues, among other things. But I'm going to focus on the welfare standards in zoos. So what do zoo inspectors look at in terms of animal welfare within zoos in Britain? Well, supplementing our legislation is the Standards of Modern Zoo Practice. These are some very broad, general standards that are to be regarded as a minimum, but also more akin to a code of practice. They have been regularly updated. I think the last revamp was in 2004. They themselves are supplemented by the Zoos Forum Handbook. That is more detailed, more expansive guidance commissioned by what was then the Zoos Forum, which was the government expert committee on zoo matters. And of course, there are some species-specific guidelines out there. Obviously, this is something I'm going to touch on again in a minute. There aren't, in my view, enough species-specific guidelines, but those that are out there, both in terms of British but also global standards, can be called upon for inspectors to use when assessing the standards of welfare in zoos. And generally speaking, the inspectors record all their observations on a standardised form, or pro forma. That pro forma asks a number of questions, of which 47 are related to animal welfare. And these 47 are grouped into what roughly equates to the five freedoms. So, for example, this is one section, which would be the provision of protection from fear and distress. And, just to point out, it is a simple yes, no, not applicable, and notes system. I must add, though, that... I'll get to that in a minute, I'm sorry. So, these reports are sent to the local authority, of which, like I say, there's 400. There is a request that these reports are then sent to central government, but that's not necessarily the case. And even those that do are not actually analysed or reviewed in any systematic way. So in effect, the information that these reports contain stops at local authority level. And local authorities are not necessarily comparing information with each other. So nobody really had an idea of what these reports contained across the industry within the country. So, did some digging, came up with 192 of these reports for 192 zoos from between 2005 and 2008. And what I looked at, given that the standards to which they're being assessed are basically minima, I wanted to look at the areas where zoos were being judged by inspectors not to meet the standard. And I've called that substandard or failing. It's just a term. Obviously, where the inspector has ticked no, they do not meet that, that's obvious. But it also became clear on reviewing these reports that there was a second category of what you might call yes, but. So the inspector is ticking yes, but then attaching, as they are allowed to do, a mandatory condition for that zoo to improve by the time of the next inspection. So it's clear that in that case, the zoo is not actually currently meeting the standard, regardless of whether or not they've put yes in the box. So for the purposes of this study, I have lumped those two together. I can obviously, in the fuller paper, they will be expanded upon, and it is clear that there's certainly a few yes buts, but the no's themselves are significant. So, this is all the zoos in the UK in the sample. This is the summary results. Just to point out a couple of key things here. So, zero criteria judged to be substandard. Just a couple of highlights. Only 35% of the zoos in the sample were judged to meet all the standards relating to provision of animal health care, whereas 95% were judged to be meeting the standards for provision of protection from fear and distress. And just to give it's not just at that end of things, also more than two criteria judged to be substandard. Nearly half of the zoos were judged not to meet the standard for two or more criteria on provision of animal health care. And looking at zoos overall, less than a quarter of zoos scored 100%, which was a surprise, I'll be honest. That's just a graphical representation of what I've just displayed. I thought it was useful just to see what the type of risk factors that we can get out of this are. What are the types of zoos that are not necessarily performing so well? There's a system in the UK where zoos can be given a full license. That would be much more likely to be the sort of facility such as, let's say, if Detroit was in the UK, a larger mixed collection, whereas a dispensation, which reduces the sort of regulatory burden slightly on the zoo, would be given to a premises that has less animals, less diversity of species, that kind of thing. And actually what this shows is that just on this particular aspect, again, provision of animal health care, dispensation, zoos with a dispensation on their license actually perform worse than zoos with a full license. So again, it might be that these type of facilities need a bit more careful examination under the inspection system. And the type of zoo, I mentioned before the types of facility that are licensed in the UK, all of these listed here. These are not my classifications, this is a classification by the local authority. And you'll see, again, that for animal healthcare, and that's provision of protection from fear and distress, and again, overall, that there is significant difference between the type of zoo, with standout points being farm parks, by which I mean it's a facility that started off keeping domesticated species but has gone into exotics, hence needing a zoo license. They perform particularly poorly relative to the other categories. I also looked at accreditation and see whether that had any influence on things. And just to point out, in this graph, the lower, because it's a mean rank, the lower score implies a better performance. In the UK, our regional or national accreditation body is BIARZA, the British and Irish Association of Zoos and Aquaria. They are very akin to the AZA in some ways. They don't have a mandatory inspection to join BIARZA, unlike AZA, as I understand it. But what this shows, those categories marked with the asterisks or stars, or at least they were, so this one, and this one, are significantly different, and BIARZA zoos are performing better than non-BIARZA zoos, but that doesn't apply to the other criteria. Which again was a surprise. One would have expected perhaps that BIARZA would outperform all other zoos on all the criteria. Let's look at the individual criteria assessed, and prior to this I've been lumping them all into each of the freedoms. And again, this was quite surprising, concerning. More than 25% of zoos were being judged to be substandard on a review of clinical and pathological records. Just less than 25% of zoos marked to be substandard as having a satisfactory program of veterinary and curative care established and maintained. And you'll see all those marked in red are all to do with animal healthcare. So there's clearly an emphasis on animal healthcare and perhaps a flagging it up as an area that's not performing very well in zoos in the UK. And this table just shows that, as you might expect, zoos that perform poorly on one section perform poorly on others. Zoos that perform better on one section perform better on others. So in effect, there are better zoos and there are worse zoos, as you might expect in many ways. So other indicators that came to light from the reports: 39% of zoos across the country had not implemented an ethical review process to the standard, which, again, ethical review can touch on many things, including animal welfare. Again, concerningly, nearly a quarter of the zoos had not implemented the mandatory changes required at a previous inspection, and that could be anything 3 years or beyond beforehand, which again shows that the system is, while it may flag up problems, where's the enforcement? So, looking at the animal welfare results that this has generated, I mean, I think the results are surprising, especially given that the standards are a minimum. Accreditation doesn't seem to guarantee better overall welfare performance. But it has flagged up certain possible risk factors that need, I think, more investigation, such as the type of the zoo and the dispensation of their licence. But also in doing this, it's not just about the results generated, but also the process. A few things became clear. 192 inspections, only one lasted more than one day, based on the reports. Obviously, the zoos can be quite small, but they can also be quite large. There are about 20 or so zoo inspectors, and within the sample, that equated to 59 different teams of inspector. That's quite a lot to ensure consistency between, to guarantee that they're all assessing things the same way. And perhaps concerningly, in terms of a legislative process, 11% or more, actually, of inspections were not carried out by the full complement of inspectors as required by the law. The inspectors are encouraged to use an optional scoring system for those zoos that do meet the standard of, and that's a 1 to 4, you know, 4 meaning barely adequate, 1 being excellent. That's only employed in 38% of inspections, which I think is a missed opportunity to highlight those areas where zoos are meeting the standard more than they should do. And as I pointed out, the inspectors are of two parts, competent others and veterinarians. The presence of a veterinarian as one of the inspection team didn't affect the assessment of animal welfare, which perhaps is an indicator that there's some sort of consistency, but that's reassuring. So the limitations of the current system, as I see them, it would be hard to imagine that you can fully guarantee the welfare, or assessing the welfare of a large zoo in less than or up to a day, especially not every 3 to 4 years. The design of the pro forma that's used, yes or no, is far too simplistic in my view. And this use of yes, but, again, is a bit of a concern. Some of the questions that the inspectors are asked to comment on, I've given two examples there. You know, a zoo of several thousand or tens of thousands of individual animals, answering that, you know, each animal is provided with a high standard of husbandry, or all animals appear to be in good health, seems a bit of a long shot. And I'll come back to that just in a second. The reliability and consistency between the inspectors isn't tested. Like I've said, there is no difference between the presence or absence of a veterinarian inspector. So that's an indication that there may be some consistency, but that needs more work in my view. And what's quite clear is that the inspectors are not making it clear what standards they are using when they're assessing welfare, what measures they are taking, what indicators they are looking at. So just going back to these questions, is each animal provided with a high standard of husbandry? Are they literally guaranteeing that every single animal is provided with a high standard of husbandry? Are they taking a sample? Are they doing just a general overview and say, you know, it looks like mostly they're okay? What is needed is an indication of the sampling process. And as an extension of that, an indication of the variability in welfare. Because one inspector may say 99% of animals, their welfare is absolutely top-notch, 1% that it's terrible, but overall everything's fine. Or, and that, you know, that 1% of the animals is quite an important percent for those animals. Or is it that generally everybody's okay, or is it that 100% of the animals are absolutely top-notch? There needs to be a mechanism within this process, and of course for zoos themselves to implement, a means of capturing that sort of variability in a quantitative way. This is supposed to be an opportunity for independent assessment by a government-appointed individual. Obviously, it's limited in terms of its frequency. But what I'm concerned also to see is that there's an indication that it should be used, that inspectors are being encouraged to review the zoo's own welfare assessment. So let's say look over the zoo's welfare records. That's, of course, a valid thing to do, but it doesn't actually provide any independent validation of that. It's just confirming, yes, you've got a record book, if nothing else, if there's no ground truthing of what the zoo is actually reporting. And I think the emphasis of what both the standards and the pro forma that the inspectors are using, it's almost entirely resource-based in terms of welfare provision. There's very little emphasis on welfare outcomes. And the weighting between the five freedoms, there seems to be a quite heavy emphasis on provision of animal health care and much less on provision of an opportunity to express normal behaviour. So a few recommendations to finish. So as I've said, inspections should be independent welfare assessments, not simply relying on re-emphasising what the zoo is already suggesting they do in terms of welfare assessment. In this system, the reporting and enforcement of mandatory conditions attached to a license, so that's a mandatory requirement to improve, needs to be improved. This use of yes, but needs to be stopped unless it needs to be yes or no under the current system. There is no room for this unofficial yes. The detail and follow-up should be increased at high-risk zoos. There needs to be clearer rules on the duration and detail of these inspections. And the reporting of what welfare indicators used is absolutely necessary, and somehow a measure of including a degree of the variability would be very useful, with a greater emphasis on welfare outcomes. Centralisation and review of inspection results across the industry, as happens in the UK for inspection of animals kept in laboratories, for example, so that, you know, the model is there. And it would be very easy for a centralised, for these reports to be collated and analysed centrally, but it hasn't happened to date. And I'm sure many of you will agree that there is an urgent need for scientifically validated species-specific guidelines. I know certain people have remarked in the past that what is currently out there, I know it is increasing, but to date has, for too long, been based perhaps on folklore and not validated. So many thanks for listening, and thanks again.